locked in conflict, think of the grace of God.
These years also included 13 years of prohibition, an extraordinary attempt to legislate morality by outlawing alcohol, but instead, it was a failure in outlawing alcohol, instead proved a launchpad for organized crime, racketeering, and the growth of the mafia. First cousin to organized crime is corruption. And in America in these years, corruption was a disease which infected democracy from the cop on his beat to the precinct captain, the ward councillor, the mayor, and the senator. Capitalism red in tooth and claw, city life corroded by crime and corruption, and an intense awareness of the tension between American individualism on the one hand and a society based on mass production and the concentration of political power on the other hand. These are the domestic elements that shaped private eye detective fiction. So that's the context in which this genre, subgenre emerged. Unusually, we can also say with some precision exactly when they entered American culture. In 1920, a magazine called Black Mask was launched. Fascinatingly, it was a money-making venture. It was intended simply to cover the losses being incurred on a highbrow literary journal. One of the two people involved was H.L. Mencken, for those familiar with American culture. Black Mask carried short stories, crime, westerns, and romance stories at first, but by 1924, it had become entirely a vehicle for crime fiction. A number of writers wrote stories set in cities, featuring rough and ready detectives with tongues as sharp as their minds. And among these writers were Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, who between them created, defined, and dominated the private eye genre between the wars. Hammett wrote several stories in the mid-20s featuring a detective who's never named but described himself simply as the Continental Op. Now, Op was shorthand for operative, and the Op worked for the Continental Detective Agency, Continental Op. And importantly, his experiences and this usage are based on Hammett's own first-hand experience as an operative for the Pinkerton Detective Agency. He worked for them before and after serving in the American Army Ambulance Corps. But he resigned in 1922. Hammett was a left-winger. He resigned in 1922, disillusioned by the Pinkerton Agency's role in strike-breaking. Then in 1927 and 1928, Black Mask ran a serial in four parts. It was very successful, so in 1929, Hammett found a publisher for it to come out as a novel. And this was Hammett's Red Harvest. The story is told by the Continental Op. His voice, laconic, streetwise, direct. It opens with these words. I'm not going to attempt now or any time tonight an American accent. Continental Op. I first heard Personville called Poisonville by a red-haired mucker named Hickey Dewey in the big ship at Butte. He also called his shirt a shoit. I didn't think of anything what he'd done to the city's name. Later, I heard men who could manage their R's give it the same pronunciation. I still didn't see anything in it but the meaningless sort of humour that used to make Richard Snary the thieves' word for dictionary. A few years later, I went to Personville and learned better. Personville was a Midwestern mining town. The Continental Op is hired by the local newspaper editor, a man called Don Wilson, a decent man appalled by what is happening in this company town. It seethes with violence and corruption. In order to break the local trade union, gangs of hoodlums have been shipped in by the mine owners. And the mine owners also have corrupt policemen and politicians on their payroll. By the time the op arrives in Personville, Wilson is dead. He speaks to a man out in a crumpled grey suit outside the police station. "What's the rumpus?" I asked him. He looked at me carefully before he replied, as if he wanted to be sure that the information was going into safe hands. His eyes were as grey as his clothes, but not so soft. "Don Wilson's gone to sit on the right hand of God, if God don't mind looking at bullet holes." "Who shot him?" I asked. The grey man scratched the back of his neck. "Somebody with a gun." The op then meets the dead man's father, Elihu Wilson, who effectively ran Personville. He owned the local mining company, the bank, both of the city's newspapers. Quote, "Along with these pieces of property, he owned a United States senator, a couple of representatives, the governor, the mayor, and most of the state legislature." The op stays on, now hired by the older Wilson, and he's charged with cleansing Personville. This is a trope already familiar from the Western, right? The sheriff who comes in to clean up a town. The op is plunged into a complex and extremely violent sequence of events, punctuated by killings, shootouts, double crosses, beatings, and betrayals. By the book's end, the gang leaders and the corrupt police chief are all dead. The op forces Elihu Wilson to call on the state's governor to send in the National Guard. But it is not a straightforward victory. For one thing, the op is aware of how his own decency has been compromised by steps he had to take. And for another, although the gangs have been defeated, Wilson still runs the town. And this moral ambiguity, this shades of black and white, is a keynote of private eye fiction. Other distinctive elements of the genre are present in this first full-length novel. The story is told in the voice and from the standpoint of the investigator. He is a loner, a decent man, but made cynical and world-weary by his working environment. And although he's investigating a crime, he gets involved in personal, often a family issue. And a final, frequently repeated trope is the role played by a devious woman. Here, she is sultry, greedy Dinah Brand, a shop-worn femme fatale. The op calls her a soiled dove, a deluxe hustler, a big league gold digger. And readers of private eye detective fiction will meet her counterpart again and again. And then in 1930, Hammett wrote a novel featuring a private investigator called Sam Spade. Spade only appears in this book, but it is Hammett's masterpiece and one of the best known of all detective fictions. And apart from anything else, it occasioned the Christmas present from my wife, the Maltese Falcon. She said I should dress in costume every evening from now on, but I'm not going to. I reread The Maltese Falcon in preparation for this course, and I can think of few books in any genre that have as much to offer on second and third encounter. There is Sam Spade himself, with grey-yellow eyes and a long, bony jaw. He looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan. And as we observe him, as we follow him through the tightly plotted twists and turns, we learn that he is self-contained and selfish, that he is tough mentally and physically, and the toughness can be pretty harsh. Sam Spade wastes no words, time, money, or love. The novel also has a superbly realized femme fatale. We meet her on page one as Miss Wonderly, a client. She is so shy as to be almost inaudible. She enters the room, quote, slowly with tentative steps. She can hardly speak as she tortured her lower lip with glistening teeth and said nothing. But we learn soon enough that her entire tale of a lost sister is untrue, and that although she's booked into her hotel as Miss LeBlanc, her real name is Bridget O'Shaughnessy. She's got too many names, Spade mused. She and Sam Spade become... It's okay. Maybe you can come help me here. Unless... Yeah, I think I've won. Okay. Bridget and Spade become lovers, but they never cease being adversaries. And the famous denouement of the novel reveals to the reader what Sam Spade has suspected all along, and the consequences of this for Bridget. And that's before its bleak, enigmatic ending. His secretary comes to tell him that his murdered partner's widow, with whom he's had an adulterous affair before the sequence of the book, and whom he's been keeping at arm's length throughout the story, is there to see him, I'm quoting. She, the secretary, she said in a small, flat voice, "Ivor is here." Spade, looking down at his desk, nodded almost imperceptibly. "Yes," he said, and shivered. "Well, send her in." That's how the book ends. But if Hammett largely invented a new language, a new type of investigator, and a new symbolic landscape, it was Raymond Chandler who took that material and reworked it in a glittering, highly polished form. Chandler first wrote over a dozen short stories, detective stories, in Black Mask and Dime Detective, experimenting with names, plots, style, similes. Lots of the stuff that he plays with in the short stories actually recur in the novels. It was a deliberate, self-conscious apprenticeship. And then in 1939, he moved up a gear with the publication of The Big Sleep, as stunning a first novel as one could hope for. It opens, for me, quite unforgettably, with the private eye, Philip Marlowe, arriving at the opulent estate of Colonel Sternwood. I was wearing my powder blue suit with dark blue shirt, tie and display handkerchief, black brogues, black wool socks with dark blue clocks on them. I was neat, clean, shaved and sober, and I didn't care who knew it. I was everything the well-dressed private detective ought to be. I was calling on $4 million. Unquote. 2 pages on, and we're in the hothouse, steamy room full of tropical orchids. The plants fill the place, a forest of them with nasty, meaty leaves and stalks like the newly washed fingers of dead men. Colonel Sternwood, an old and obviously dying man in a wheelchair, quoting again, spoke slowly, using his strength as carefully as an out-of-work showgirl uses her last pair of stockings. He tells Marlowe, about his beautiful but immoral daughters, Vivian and Carmen. Quote, neither of them has any more moral sense than a cat. Marlowe agrees to look into the man who's pressing the colonel to pay the gambling debts of the younger daughter, Carmen. He says, okay, he'll look into this. And he's plunged immediately into an investigation of pornography, blackmail, violence, and murder. Throughout this fast-moving story, Marlowe keeps explaining that he is not looking for Rusty Regan. I'm not looking for Rusty Regan, he keeps saying. That was the colonel's son-in-law, who's Vivian's husband, who's apparently walked out on the Fernwood family. But by the closing page, he paradoxically finds that he is looking for Regan, and that he's been doing so all along without knowing it. I don't want to reveal any more about the ending, but Marlowe is back where he began, in the Fernwood house. His journey has travelled full circle. And this notion of parallel searches, one for the original crime, the other as family secrets spool out, is used in almost every Chandler novel and becomes a central feature of the Private Eye story as a whole. In 1944, Chandler published a famous and very influential essay called The Simple Art of Murder. It was partly a critique of the clue puzzle detective story, partly a tribute to Dashiell Hammett as the pioneer of the hard-boiled school, and partly a manifesto for that form of detective fiction. He is utterly dismissive of the American and English clue puzzle writers. He finds their work formulaic and repetitious. Whichever detective arrives on the crime scene, he calls the English clue puzzle writers Cheesecake Manor. Whichever detective arrives at Cheesecake Manor, quote, what he does when he gets there is the same old fussing around with timetables and bits of charred paper and who trampled the jolly old flowering arbutus under the library window. The American writers try to update their tales, he says, but, quote, fundamentally, it is the same careful grouping of suspects, the same utterly incomprehensible trick of how someone stabbed Mrs. Pottington Postlethwaite III with the solid platinum poniard. The plots and the solutions are contrived. His view of the famous solution of Christie's, the murder on the Orient Express, only a half-wit could guess it. He says these stories do not really come off intellectually as problems, and they do not come off artistically as fiction. In contrast, Dashiell Hammett's crime fiction was fundamentally different. He was one of a group writing, or trying to write, realistic mystery fiction to rescue it from English gentility and American pseudo-gentility, and to set it in the world he knew. A longish quote coming up. He made some of it up, all writers do, but it had a basis in fact. It was made of real things. Hammett gave murder back to the kind of people who commit it. For reasons, and with the means at hand, he made them talk and think in the language they customarily use for these purposes. He was spare, frugal, hard-boiled, but he did over and over again what only the best writers can ever do at all. He wrote scenes that seemed never to have been written before. Unquote. However, realism is only part of the case he makes for the new fiction. That realism was not enough for Dash Hammett, and quite clearly not for Raymond Chandler. The new crime fiction, he wrote, must have a quality of redemption, a moral purpose. And he spelled this out in a famous passage. Longish quote, but down these mean streets a man must go who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid. The detective in this kind of story must be such a man. He is the hero, he is everything. He must be a complete man and a common man, and yet an unusual man. He must be, to use a rather weathered phrase, a man of honor. I don't care much about his private life. He's neither a eunuch nor a satyr. I think he might seduce a duchess, and I'm quite sure he would not spoil a virgin. If he is a man of honor in one thing, he is that in all things. He's a relatively poor man, or he would not be a detective at all. He is a common man, or he could not go among common people. End of quote. And then the essay concludes, a tad complacently, if there were enough like him, I think the world would be a very safe place to live in, and yet not too dull to be worth living in. Now, Chandler's essay not only showcased a particular kind of fiction, the work that he and Hammett represented, but this essay became a new critical orthodoxy. For a generation, Chandler's views were recycled and taken as gospel. In brief, the claims that Chandler made and others accepted were firstly that the private eye novels were realist, based on the world as it was. Secondly, that the language was naturalist, a transcription of how people spoke. And thirdly, that the morality championed by these books was fixed and stable, and that the genre embodied masculinity. Down these streets a man must go, he. Looking back now, none of these claims has survived intact. Let me just take each of them briefly in turn. Firstly, the claims to realism look extremely dated. Over the last half century, formal literary criticism has established conclusively that realism is in fact a highly artificial construct, a genre with its own narrative conventions. Chandler's own novels, for example, are superficially realist accounts of a contemporary, intrepid investigator carrying out criminal investigations. But they are also romances of a particular sort, consciously modelled on a much, much older literary form, the quest. Have a look at the second paragraph of The Big Sleep. After, you know, his shoes and his socks and his shave comes this. He's outside the Sternwood house. Over the entrance doors, which would have let in a troop of Indian elephants, there was a broad stained glass panel showing a knight in dark armor rescuing a lady who was tied to a tree and didn't have any clothes on, but some very long and convenient hair. The knight had pushed the visor of his helmet back to be sociable, and he was fiddling with the knots on the ropes that tied the lady to the tree. Okay, he plays it for laughs, but he also makes explicit the comparison between Marlowe and that medieval knight, the knight-errant, the crusader, the questing hero of romance. Later on in the book, Marlowe comes home to his own home to find that the wanton, willful Carmen Fernwood has let herself into his apartment and is lying naked on his bed. There's a chess problem laid out on its board. I reached down and moved a knight. All this time the soft giggling went on from the bed, a sound that made me think of rats behind a wainscoting in an old house. Won't you please get dressed, Carmen? Your name isn't Doghouse Riley, she said. It's Philip Marlowe. You can't fool me. I looked down at the chessboard. The move with the knight was wrong. I put it back where I'd moved it from. Knights had no meaning in this game. It wasn't a game for knights. The game that Marlowe's involved in, Chandler is reminding us, wasn't a game for knights. In a later book, The High Window, Marlowe himself makes the comparison explicit. He sardonically refers to himself as a shop-soiled Galahad. The critic Fred Jamison puts it crisply. In formal terms, Chandler's books are all descriptions of searches, quests. The romance of the quest cohabits with the realism in every Chandler novel. Secondly, critics following Chandler's essay argue that the language of these novels was naturalist, that it was spoken in the accents and idioms of the common man, a no-nonsense democratic register. But look a little closer, listen a little harder, and it's absolutely evident that what's presented by Chandler as everyday speech is in fact highly stylized. That inimitable voice of Philip Marlowe is not an echo of street slang, but is the vernacular heightened and burnished to the level of streetwise poetry. The filmmaker Billy Wilder famously said of Chandler's writing that a kind of lightning struck on every page. And all Chandler fans will have their own favorite Chandlerisms, the similes and metaphors so central to his style. Here are just a few. Old men with faces like lost battles. Her voice got as cool as a cafeteria dinner. The room was as empty as a headwaiter's smile. The purring voice was now as false as an usherette's eyelashes. And you'll find many more. But let me just end with a last echo of Marlowe. This is a moment of crisis in Farewell, My Lovely. I needed a drink. I needed a lot of life insurance. I needed a vacation. I needed a home in the country. What I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun. I put them on and left the room. Thirdly, it is sometimes assumed that the hard-boiled format provided a consistent, stable, moral and political position, that of American individualism with a white male romantic hero pitted against a corrupt state, a position both democratic and doomed. Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe on a first read appear to embody masculinity. But on closer inspection, they seem to have the skills, the attributes, the persona of the all-American male. But a closer reading shows, I think, that what they depict is a masculinity constantly under threat. Although Chandler claimed that the crimes that Philip Marlowe is up against were those of organized crime and corrupt politicians, in fact, every Chandler novel has an inner story where Marlowe is threatened or betrayed by a manipulative, deceitful woman. For Chandler, real villainy is simple and consistent. It was a woman who done it. The femme fatale and her sexuality pose the biggest threat to the masculinity of the detective. Hammett invented the private eye novel. Chandler refined and romanticized it, but it was further enriched and enhanced by Ross Macdonald, the third of the big three. Ross Macdonald is no longer widely read, but from the 50s to the 70s, his private eye novels, featuring Lou Archer, not only enjoyed a huge readership, but also highbrow literary recognition. Two of the most influential critics in America passed judgment in the New York Times Review of Books. One of them wrote, 10 years ago, while nobody was watching, a writer of detective stories turned into a major American novelist. Another judged the Lou Archer books to be, quote, the finest series of detective novels ever written by an American. I read them avidly 30 years ago and very much enjoyed rereading a few for this course. Like Hammett and Chandler, Macdonald located his stories in California, but this time in a fictional city called Santa Rosa. But whereas Chandler locked Marlowe into a fairly tight formula, MacDonald sends Archer off in different directions. In his own words, MacDonald writing about these books, "I gradually siphoned off the aura of romance and made room for a social realism." In other words, Santa Rosa is not frozen in time, but is affected by contemporary issues: drugs, environmental damage, generational tensions, dysfunctional families, the Vietnam War, gender relations, and so on. Lou Archer is a licensed private investigator, but there are times when his techniques seem to be those of a psychoanalyst. MacDonald again. While Archer is a man of action, his actions are largely directed to putting together the story of other people's lives and discovering their significance. He is less a doer than a questioner, a consciousness in which the meanings of other lives emerge. This conception of the detective hero as the mind of the novel is probably my main contribution to this special branch of fiction." Unquote. Archer is every bit as eloquent as Philip Marlowe, but darker, more reflective, more pessimistic. And if I were asked to nominate just one Lou Archer novel to get you hooked, it would be The Galton Case, which is on the handout. The big three tower over this private eye format, but it certainly did not come to an end when they stopped writing. On the contrary, the basic framework which they established has proved remarkably reusable. It's been adopted, adapted, reinvented by many, many authors, put to new functions. For one example, Walter Mosley wrote a dozen novels in the 1990s and 2000s, but they all set in Los Angeles of the 1950s. They star a private detective named Ezekiel Easy Rawlins. Easy Rawlins is black. He lives and works in Watts, the inner city area of Los Angeles with a mainly African-American population. So you're getting an immediate reversal of the older private eye tradition. And this is made explicit in the opening pages of the first Easy Rawlins novel, Devil in a Blue Dress. What he does is a kind of reworking of the opening of Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely, where Moose Malloy, the great giant of a man, Moose Malloy enters a bar in search of his lost love, Velma, shoots him near the end of the book, and he's met with hostility by the all-black clientele. Mosley also has a white man enter a black bar, but the point of view and the values are those of the regulars, not of the intruder. It's a beautiful kind of inversion of that. And Mosley uses his novels to make commentaries on American racism and inequality. Another highly effective appropriation and remapping of the terrain staked out by those hard-boiled pioneers has been the creation of female private eyes. Perhaps the best-known authors are Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton, who created V.I. Washkansky and Kinsey Mulhone, respectively. By a publication coincidence, both these detectives appeared for the first time in novels published in 1982, and both enjoyed long careers as astute, articulate, and thoroughly autonomous female detectives. Washkansky is the tougher of the two. She's frequently involved in physical violence, but both orders use the books to explore gender roles and social issues more widely. They tend to link a particular investigation of insurance fraud, a missing person or a murder to aspects of women's condition in America that's been identified by feminist theorists who preceded them. They are self-consciously feminist private eyes. And the hard-boiled format has been reworked, relocated, and updated by some very fine crime writers, American crime writers. And they prove that the private eye, unlike the giant redwoods, could flourish outside California. John D. MacDonald, often confused with Ross MacDonald, John D. MacDonald created Travis McGee, who lived on his barge, the Busted Flush, docked in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Robert B. Parker's private investigator, highly readable series, is Spencer, who lives and works in Boston. But it's not only that New England is a continent away from California. Spencer is in a different moral world from Marlowe or Spade. He lives in a monogamous relationship with Susan Silverman, the Jewish psychologist, and he often works with Hawk and Chollo, an African-American and Mexican-American, respectively. And he generally reflects more enlightened social attitudes than the classic tradition. The same is true, and again, one of my very favorite series, James Lee Burke. James Lee Burke's private investigator, Dave Robichaud, who lives in New Iberia on the Louisiana Delta. Robichaud is a recovering alcoholic. His family life is closely narrated, and his own code, his own ethics, often pit him directly against local views on race and gender. He is, says one critic, liberalism's answer to private investigation. But although the private investigator still has some gas in his tank, he's actually been overtaken since the 1950s as the typical fictional detective. Policemen have been present in crime fiction since the 19th century. Think of Inspector Bucket in Bleak House or Sergeant Cuff in Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone. But with the emergence of Sherlock Holmes, and then the clue puzzle, and then the rise of the private eye, police were relegated to subordinate roles in these fictions. They performed certain professional functions that the detective hero could not. They could question suspects or arrest them, but they were consistently more plodding and less intelligent partners in these cooperations. Think Lestrade in the Holmes stories or poor old Jack in the Poirot books. In the American private eye subgenre, police were often viewed very unsympathetically. Spade has an essentially antagonistic relationship with Lieutenant Dundee in The Black Falcon. The corrupt cop is central to Chandler's The Lady in the Lake. And Marlowe mentions in a matter-of-fact way during The Long Goodbye that Captain Gregorius solves crimes with a kick to the kidneys, the knee to the groin, the fist to the solar plexus, and the nightstick to the base of the spine. And yet, after World War II, there was a dramatic change in the way police were depicted, especially in America. There rapidly emerged a subgenre which placed the police at the very center of crime fiction, and not just a single idealized, highly cerebral policeman, but a team of skilled, hardworking professionals. For the first time ever, writers began to examine real cops and the fascinating, tedious, traumatic, and thankless job that they do, and the ways in which their employment impacts upon them. Various explanations for the shift have been suggested. Perhaps the war itself promoted the idea of a group of men working together for good purposes. The hard-boiled novels have already made crime fiction more realistic and less artificial than the clue puzzle, and from here it was a short step to a subgenre that corresponded more closely to the actual world. Radio and television covered real crime. And who speaks about it on radio and television? Policemen. It became increasingly artificial to suggest that crime was most effectively combated by private investigators. As Evan Hunter wrote, the last time a private eye investigated a homicide was never. Evan Hunter was a prolific novelist, perhaps still best known for his The Blackboard Jungle, but he's probably better known when writing as Ed McBain. It was Ed McBain who did more than any other writer to establish the popularity in America of the police procedural novel. He wasn't the first. Lawrence Treat, Hilary Waugh preceded him with books that took police work seriously. But from 1956, with the publication of Cop Hater, that's the first, his 87th Precinct saga really defined the field. The 87th Precinct is set in a fictional city named Isola. And there's a map of Isola at the front of every one. But if you rotate it by 90 degrees, it will see a striking resemblance to New York. Where McBain was most innovative was in establishing not a single cop or a single investigator, but a cast, a team of characters, members of the precinct force, and then using them from one book to the next as a kind of repertory company. Steve Carella, an Italian-American policeman, is the lead actor, if you will, but each story will foreground one or more of the other members of an increasingly familiar cast. Maya Maya, Bert Kling, Cotton Halls, Arthur Brown, and the rest. As those names suggest, the detectives of the 87th Precinct Squadron mirror the ethnic diversity of New York. In addition to Carella, Italian-American, other cops represent Irish Americans, African Americans, German Americans, Jewish Americans, and so on. Gender is less well represented. Eileen Burke is the only female detective in the precinct. McBain also cemented into place the other elements that came to define the police procedure. Firstly, routines and procedures are faithfully reported. He quite often will put, a replica of a form filled in, etc., as part of the book. Taking witness statements, completing the paperwork, conducting surveillance, bagging items of evidence for forensic examination, and so on. Secondly, police officers are individualized. They're given personalities. We watch them interacting with each other, cooperating and squabbling. We learn details about their private lives. There's an emphasis not only on what they do, but how they think. And thirdly, McBain suggested that his detectives bond together. They work as a team against various external forces, not only against crime, but against public opinion, often hostile to police, and against their superiors, who work them too hard and value them too little. This basic format was highly portable. By the mid-1990s, there was scarcely a major city in the United States that had not been used as the setting for a police novel. That quote ended with police novel rather than police procedural. And I think this accurately conveys that the police procedural is an older format, the sort of McBain type, that has now broadened or diversified into something distinct. That's a novel of crime fiction featuring a policeman or a group of policemen in various different ways. Less preoccupied now with the actual procedures and the routines than they used to be, but again, very, very much taken up with police as working professions. The police novel is now the most typical form of crime fiction. It's well established in the United States, in England, across Europe. I'll talk about the Scandinavians tomorrow. And increasingly finding new international variants. No longer primarily about procedure, it uses the lives, the working lives of policemen and policewomen, as a fruitful way of telling stories about crime, about justice, about the society and its frailties, and about communities. My fourth and fifth lecture will consider how the police novel has flourished in different locales, including South Africa. Thank you very much. Sorry, let just the rustle die down. I'm being asked about the relationship between Sam Spade and his secretary, who's called Miss... she's absolutely delightful. She's utterly devoted to Spade, and Spade treats her something rotten. But when he's in a crisis, when he needs to hide Bridget, it's to the secretary's house that she is taken. He calls her right at the end of the book. He said something like, I wish I'd got it written down. He says something along these lines to her. He said, I'm going to invent her name, Velma. He said, you're one of the best chaps there are. And there's a kind of masculinizing of her right through the book. We're told she's got a low voice. She's got short, her hair's in a bob. And there's a very interesting way in which she's crucial to the book. And she's there in the first paragraph and the last, that one that I read. She says, Ida's here to see you. And yet she's got this very, very strange function in the novel. I wish he'd written other Sam Spade stories and we'd know how he developed that. But that's a very interesting question. Did you enjoy the book? Is it which version? Okay, so that's what they showed. Okay, just a word about movies and TV. The genres I've described tonight can hardly be imagined without reference to film and television. Because, of course, the private eye, the hard-boiled genre, translated directly into film rock, into the great films of the 1940s and 50s. Lucky enough for the Big Sleep to have Howard Hawks, and for the long, John Huston, The Big Sleep, and Howard Hawks for Farewell My Lovely, two of the defining film noirs of all time. And black and white film lent itself so superbly to this shifting moral world of the Chandler books and the others. Then along comes television. In America, Dragnet, LAPD, New York City News, etc. In Britain, lots of homegrown police television series. I'm going to be talking about one, I'm going to be talking about more tomorrow evening. But again, I think that the TV and film and books cross-pollinate. Don't they? They kind of cement each other's popularity. But it's very difficult for me to read A full of knowledge of without seeing Humphrey Bogart. So. Very good place to start.
I cannot read any of these old books.
Anyone?
I can't read the Morris, I can't read the McDonald's. I haven't done the name, but I can't read the Sylvia once.
Okay. Somebody who's been reading contemporary pictures all her life, but can't get into these in the private eye.
But then I need to ask them and say, what about Dominion and Italy? Neil from Scotland, Brandon from Scotland, Lawson from Scotland.
No, because I think in American culture, I'm talking about this subgenre, the private eye genre, is almost unthinkable without also thinking about film noir. That's the point I'm making. And the police procedure is difficult to think about and discuss without referring to television series. I think that's very tongue-in-cheek that he did say that, yes. There's also one of the other stories that's often told. One of the films was being made that they telegraphed. They said, you know, who did kill so-and-so? You know, Regan in The Big Sleep. And Chandler telegraphed back and said, I don't know either. It's not true, but it's a good story. I don't know either. No, I didn't know that. No Orchids for Miss Blandish, banned in Britain. I didn't know that. I can't imagine why. First you?
No.
No, I don't know those. I'm going to be talking about that particular trope, the damaged policeman, the damaged private investigator, in a later series. I'm just standing time to show about the impact of their work on this issue.
Just looking at the subgenre of the Bible of the experiments in my end, James and Chester, in the I'm surprised you can
I'm asked, I didn't mention in the Hard Boiled, James having chased and Mickey Spillane. Mickey Spillane is a kind of right-wing, near-fascist version of Chandler. I find his politics so repulsive that I long ago stopped reading them. Hadley Chase, if you've read one, you've read them all. I'm sorry to be so sniffy, but there's so many books out there, I have learned to be a little bit discriminating. Once I wasn't. Yes, sir.
And James Elroy.
Elroy is absolutely wonderful. The L.A. James Elroy, written, again in the 90s and 2000s, but set earlier, set in Los Angeles. L.A. Confidential. Wonderful film. That's one of his trilogy, the L.A. Confidential trilogy. But they are some of the most wonderfully written and dark, absolutely saturnine news. The Black Dahlia is based on the death of his mother. Famous unsolved murder case. His mother was a good town girl in Los Angeles. And he didn't make that public until years later, but the Black Dahlia is about his own life. Wonderful writing, James Elroy. Elmore Leonard is another of my particular American favorites. Elmore Leonard, died a few months ago. Get Shorty.
Patricia Cornwell. There's a whole bunch of books which have made forensic pathology the sort of center of the show. I think it was one of the first. And I think there's only so many novels you can write about face stuff it, cutting up corpses. And once you've seen one set of entrails, I think you've seen
okay.
I think people need to go. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
I was just wondering, probably much too light-hearted for what you're doing, but how about a black lady detective?
There are some.
And how about one who's featured in Botswana, Mara Motsu?
Oh, yeah.
Is that really a series of short stories and not part of the genre?
I think they're quite fun. But they're sort of first cousin to the genre, aren't they?
Yes.
They're much better black women detectives in Dion Mayer that I'm talking about on Friday
that's
night.
That's a bit interesting, because that's the North West I don't know.
Mbali, which means flower in Zulu, Mbali Kaleni. She's wonderful.
But well, you'll hear about maybe her. We should go and get one of those books, because there are some of those books.
Which is Dion Mayer?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to inspecting the horse.
Good.
I love those books.
I need to find out when I start whether people know them from the books or the TV.
Well, it's both. Yeah, with me anyway. I didn't realise that the writer, he always has himself in the Inspector Morse thoughts, which is rather sweet. Which is gradually, because Lewis isn't described in the first books as the Lewis is
no,
in the book.
Not.
But they got more like the books. Well, the book's got more like him.
Well, Lewis, of course, is now a man in his own right, isn't
he?
Yes.
Well, now they've got a third spin-off called Endeavour. Has that been shown here
yes.
yet?
The Young Morse. I don't Morse. Know about here. It's oh. been shown in England.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. That's about Young Morse.
I love the genre. Anyway, thank you so
good.
Much.
Good. Thank you very much. Do you want this?
Waiting for us at the top. Oh, because she's been for me.
The Americans have to print. Correct your pronunciation. Travis McGee.
It's McGee, is it? Thank
McGee.
You. I said McGee. Yeah. No, I would normally say Travis McGee. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, quite right.
You're obviously very up on American mystery writers. So.
Yeah. Right. Do you read them too?
Oh, of course.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
Who's your favorite? Who do you like?
Currently, Donna Leon.
Okay. Although they set in Venice, but she's very good.
Well, and she's American.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
No, I just, the whole social realism is, I don't know, do you have a different, who's your favorite mystery writer?
Sherlock Holmes.
Oh,
you can't go wrong with that.
I still read them. I go back and reread them maybe once every 10 years,
yep,
something like
about,
that.
That's exactly what I do. Wonderful introducing my kids to them. Okay, thanks very much.
And we live in Boston, so...
Spencer. Yeah. Robert B. Parker.
Spencer doesn't have a first name.
Joan died in December. But the person at the estate authorized to write in Spencer's names. No.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Is it still open at the top?
Yeah, it is.